Hello and welcome to episode 104 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Well, hi, Matt. Here we are again, and welcome to the last episode of March. I think we're on now, aren't we?
Is this the Ides?
This is the Ides now. And also the last episode of what we will call winter. Or is this now spring? I don't know. It's certainly getting a bit lighter, isn't it?
The equinox was a few days ago, I think. I never remember the autumn and spring ones. But yeah, the nights are getting longer. It's all good. It's all good.
Yeah, the clock's probably going forward, spring forward, isn't it? So,
yes, that's next weekend. Although it's been it's weird. My wife spends a lot of time working with US people on conference calls, and the US, there's always a little bit of overlap when the time zones haven't both changed.
Yes.
But it's been 4 weeks because the US went a bit early and we're going a bit late. So she's been having early meetings and all sorts. It's been.
I turned up to a conference call last week the week before, only to find when I got there that nobody was there and everybody had gone home because they'd finished and I was an hour late because of some wretched daylight saving issue on the calendar.
Yes, it's a confusing thing. I still, the European and Asian, and because bits of Asia don't move because they're near to the equator, and I just, it's all very confusing.
I take the view, and you might call this a chauvinistic view, but I take the view that the clock and the calendar should be UTC times, because you know we're in England and we invented time, and you can see that because there's the line in Greenwich. Because we invented time, if you want to know what time it is in another part of the world, first of all, you have to know what time it is here, and then you have to do the sums. That's how time works.
Yes. It's this sort of exceptionalism that's got this country into the state it's in.
Before we invented time, did you realise things would happen like all at the same time, and that there would be no way of ordering it?
There would be no way of ordering it. There almost certainly wouldn't be.
Things just happened, you know, in very random ways.
Oh, yeah, it was the railway's fault, wasn't it? And that was another British invention. So there you go. Everybody who moans about their trains being late, it's all because the trains actually invented time so that you could measure it being late. It's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, really, isn't it?
Maybe.
Maybe. Anyway, how has your week been, other than musing about the supremacy of British time?
Let me have a think. What day is it? Well,
it's Monday. When we're recording this, it could be any day of the week because time is, of course, relative for our listeners.
Of course it is. We are not bound by the surly bonds of time, are we? We can be enjoyed at any time of the day or night.
Enjoyed a bit strong.
I can't remember what I've done this week, Matt. I don't know whether I'm coming or going. All I know is that I've had to do a lot of work and a lot of staring at this computer. And I don't even know what I did at the weekend. So you're asking me a question for which I don't have a satisfactory answer. I just know what's going on. How about yourself?
I have been doing... actually, one of the things I've been doing, and I wrote a little bit about this on my blog last week, is using voice recording with text-to-speech conversion based around natural language processing to be able to create word clouds of... relatively unstructured interviews with people as part of research I'm doing for a client at the moment, and then working out ways about being able to use those word clouds to be able to help the managers within the client be able to understand a bit about perceptions of what's going on at the moment. So rather than getting into the detail of all of the data of the unstructured interview, or trying to do it as a structured interview with nonsense numbers coming out of it, actually using word clouds as a way to summarise out sentiment-ish of what was discussed. So that's been quite exciting.
That's right, and I remember that now, because we talked about that, didn't we, on one of your
on the Global Canteen on Friday.
Global Canteen, yes. Things where Mark Wilson turned up. Hello, Mark. And I was very taken with that. I thought it was an AI powered consulting model that we shouldn't be shy about saying that it's a new paradigm in the world of consulting powered by artificial intelligence, Matt. That's your strapline.
I have to punch myself in the face though every time I use the word paradigm. There we go. There I go again. Yeah, so that was that. The other exciting thing is that from a thing that we've been talking about for ages but not actually getting around to doing anything about, the concept of the WB40 event, the live experience, is becoming reality, and it will become reality, all wind in the right direction, on the evening of Thursday the 2nd of May at Aldgate in East London, or East Central London, hosted by Dario Molinari and the wonderful people at Puppet. And we are going to have an evening where we're going to do some interviews for the show, and we're going to do some games with the priority cards that I've been working on, and we might do some Lego stuff as well, and generally get people together to be able to meet up. So if you're interested in coming along, we have a limited number of tickets. They are free of charge, but they are well prized. If you want to come along, we'll put a link on the website, or if you search WB-40 on Eventbrite, you should be able to get to where the tickets are. About half the tickets have gone already, because they were released to the WhatsApp group before general release. So if you want to be on that WhatsApp group for future advance notice of wonderful things like this, drop us a line on Twitter and we can give you the magic code to be able to join up. But it's going to be a really, really good night to be able to get people together and just chat about a few things that we talk about on the show.
Oh yes, very much looking forward to that. That sounds like a real plan. Well done, Dario, for sorting out the accommodation.
Absolutely. So with that, tonight's show we have, or today's show, or this morning's show, depending on when you're listening to us in our relative time concept.
Enjoying us.
We have Internet Yin and Yang. We have a fantastic interview with Sej Beswick, who is the head of a influencer marketing agency. She's going to be talking about the whole idea of influencer marketing and what it's about, and talked a little bit about how it might be used within organisations as well as outside. We talk about the Fire Festival and all sorts of things. That's coming up as well. So I think we probably should press on before we completely run out of time.
So, Matt, as promised, we have an interview that you did with somebody that I think you met at Silicon Beach, which is one of those events that you've been a bit of a regular at over the last few years. And Sej is from a company called Scene Connect, influencer marketing people.
That's right, yes. So I've known Sej for quite a few years now, after meeting down at the Bournemouth event. And I was fascinated to go and talk to her and find out a bit more about where the world of influencer marketing is at, especially in light of the recent publicity around the Fire Festival and how influencers were used as a sort of critical part of the building of the brand of Fire before it all went up in an immense pile of smoke. That's a bit of a mixed metaphor, but you know what I mean. So anyway, caught up with her. First thing I asked was just to give us a bit of a explanation about where the world of influencer marketing is actually at.
To start with, it has been around forever, and that's the thing I find the funniest when we get calls from brands and partners going, "Ooh, this marketing zeitgeist, we've got some influencer marketing that we want to do, and it's new and it's shiny." And my first job at Red Bull 11 years ago now was actually making sure the right type of people had a can of Red Bull in their hand at the right time. And it was called opinion leader marketing. So it obviously has then gone through various life cycles of being celebrities, YouTubers, vloggers, bloggers, and now the word influencer seems to have well and truly stuck. So in terms of what we do with our clients, we do the bread and butter is basically campaign work, which is ultimately I either want to raise awareness of product X, I want to sell more of product Y, or I want to just get people talking about whatever that may be. And we would then come up with the creative idea for that campaign, and we would then manage that end-to-end experience for them. So that involves identifying the right type of influencers, which I always think sounds really obvious. But we did have one of our first briefs 3 years ago when I set up the company was, well, you know, let's just put Joe Wicks, the body coach, who is a fitness influencer, in a suit. And if we get to do a HIIT class, we'll just sell heaps and heaps of units of suits. And you're like, well, that actually won't work. And here's all the reasons as to why. So it really is like taking a step back and understanding, like, what is that brand? What is that brand's DNA? And how do you ensure the influencers are as aligned as possible so that it isn't a kind of pay-to-play badging exercise, and that you can get the most value out of partnering with that face, that influencer. And then we will kind of onboard them, make sure that they understand the brand that they're working with and deliver results at the end, which hopefully says, look how many units you sold because of influencer X, Y, and Z. But we also do lots of like influencer strategy, or we do always on work, which is kind of aligning each month the influencer outreach based on the trading calendar and keeping that kind of momentum going on an always on basis.
So there seems to be two things within that. The first is the people that you are, I guess, representing to an extent. And then the other side of it is the method by which you're getting the campaigns to run. So the people, is it exclusively people who've built up their presence through these new channels, as opposed to, you know, an Olivia Colman, who is obviously an influencer, and the use of celebrities to be able to do marketing campaigns is also as old as advertising. So do you just focus on people who have a profile that's been built out on new channels?
No, we try to actually do slightly opposite of that, which is identifying people who have a talent and a skill set. So that could be, there is a guy in Syria who is an expert about fish, and we've worked with him on the BBC. He has 420,000 followers. There is nothing about fish that he doesn't know. But equally, it might be working with like Billy Morgan, who was the first Olympic snowboarder to win a medal. And actually the narrative, and like to use all of the marketing jargon, but like the storytelling is so much easier when someone, there is a reason as to why people are following them, versus the kind of more traditional influencer as like a bedroom blogger, which is actually, I've been in my bedroom showing how-tos for makeup, and that's how I've now got a million followers. So just in terms of like the longevity for us, we do see better results when there is a skill there as well.
And interested in how the, I guess the financial model works on that, which is presumably your clients are brands and they pay you to be able to run campaigns. Are the influencers that you're working with, the people that you're working with, are they also your clients, or are they kind of, how does all that work?
Yeah, so we don't manage any talent whatsoever. And the primary reason for that is, well, one is time. But two is also we are not kind of focused on the talent that we manage. We are completely non-biased, and it is absolutely, we will find the best person for you. So we have really good relationships with influencer agents. That said, we do have an influencer database of 52,000. Which I always say is a happy accident. It's come from like really early on, we took three influencers with a combined reach of like 4 million to Bangkok. And it was for a campaign, but when we were there, we obviously looked after them the same way you would taking any journalists away in an old school PR way. And they were doing Instagram stories and Instagram posts being like, God, it's so great to be away with Scene Connects. And we had 6,000 people apply to be in the database straight away. And so we probably haven't done enough with that database as we should and as we could. But again, it's that whole making sure it's the right type of people. And we do go to that database first and foremost, but if we get briefs that are really niche, we can call those agents and kind of ring through and chat to them to make sure that their talent that they look after is also at the forefront and kind of their profile has risen to us as well.
So you're taking a brief from a client, which might be to say, we have, a new product launching. We want to be able to get word out about our product. And so the services you're offering within that then are to be able to work out a plan of attack, the sorts of activities that you'll be doing, and then work out the sorts of people that are going to be likely to be a good match for the brand, maybe in the way that a traditional marketing campaign would look at what media channels they'd be using, which magazines or newspapers or TV channels they should use.
Exactly. And I'll give you two very extreme different campaigns. So one we finished was with Jo Malone London, which is obviously a premium, very luxury candles, perfume. And they came to us and said, we can gift celebrities our product all day, every day, and they will talk about us for free. And they can ensure that it's like the Reams and the Rosie Fortescues of this world that are really aligned in terms of brand DNA, and they genuinely love the product. But actually the brief they gave to us was they are live in 11 markets. They don't have people on the ground in 11 markets. So when it came to the creative brief, which is how do we get stills, videos, animations across our owned, earned and paid? It's looking really expensive to do one of those production shoots in every single market. And so what we came back with was actually, let's kind of incentivize brand love and those that are really kind of aware of Jo Malone London, but also your biggest advocates. And so we identified an influencer of a total of 300 nano influencers. And a nano influencer is someone who's got 2,000 followers on the platform or below. But each of those people chosen had already identified with Jo Malone in one way or another. So they may have followed them on Instagram, may have written a blog review of a product that they've experienced. They may have created a tweet showing the product that they've just purchased. So that database of people were then outreached to, and we said, look, we know you absolutely love this brand. We want to gift you some product in exchange for content that is local to your market. So Taiwan was one of them. And the way in which they use Instagram is very kind of, they turn themselves into caricatures, and it is very kind of selfie driven with product, versus in the UK, that nano group is very like flat lay flowers and around the latest edition of Vogue that they're reading. And it's kind of setting the scene. But each then worked for those local markets. So we basically use those influencers to create mass content in each of their key territories. So they were working as an extension of their creative team. And then they had 12 months usage across all of that content. So the feedback was unbelievable, because these people with like 2,000 followers who were great videographers, content creators in their own rights, and again, locally, were so excited that this brand that they loved were getting in touch for the first time and that they were supporting their journey. And on average, each person that received the product was creating about 4 assets that then could be used by that business. So it worked out with something like the cost of content was 5p, which is unheard of if you're looking at a kind of going down a very hyper-local content production cycle. Whereas on the flip side of that, if you take I'm trying to think of another example. So we work with very.co.uk, and there's various levels of degree, but actually they have a celebrity tier, which is the Holly Willoughbys, the Frankie Bridges, the Mrs. Hinches of this world, who have a huge following, usually over 1 million to 3 million. And what they want those celebrity influencers to do is actually showcase the product, how they wear it, how they style it. And it's much more around getting the brand name out there and increasing their social following so that they can then retarget off the back of having more followers on their channel. So before we started working with them, Instagram, I think for every single fashion brand, is the primary channel right now, which it definitely is for Very. And they wanted to obviously speed up their social growth. And they'd gone from a 0.4% weekly average growth to an average of a 7% growth using these celebrities to kind of just, again, keep that content going. And my favorite stat is Nielsen, which is you have to see a piece of content from a brand 11.4 times before you'll then actually convert. So actually having those influencers talking, raising the following of those social channels, that then means they can keep that messaging going. Good job.
For people outside of the marketing industry, I think one of the things that people might start to be then asking the question is, what is it that we're seeing on social networks that is actually real? What is it that's organic rather than being paid for in some sort of way? Now, there's increasing regulation happening over this sort of activity. Tell us a bit about how that's panning out.
Yeah, so we've seen a lot of that in 2019. And I think even if you had never heard the word influencer before, you now cannot miss the word influencers. And whether it's being covered in a BBC article, whether it is, Firefest that's been watched by everyone on Netflix, and now everyone's got their views on who and what an influencer is. Actually, there are a few things that have, and it's the same as like guidelines and regulations for kids being on social media. This stuff is ever changing. And subsequently, because it is changing so frequently, everyone is kind of keeping up. So the main reason why we get the clients that we do is like, one, yes, fraudulent influencers exist. And that is people who have bought their social following, they've bought their engagement. And unless you have a platform that identifies that fraudulent activity, you actually may be going for the wrong people and ghost accounts. So then you're spending all this money with actually, then you go and you come to us and go, influencer marketing doesn't work. And you're like, well, it would work if you hadn't worked with, someone who has bought their following. The second is it is getting more complicated and there are more regulations in place, which are fantastic from my side of things to see. Some of them I actually think are quite harsh. And so, for example, if you are a brand and you have, for example, you have given someone a Hyundai car, great life to be given a car, and you have been contracted to post one Instagram shot about that car for the next 12 months, anytime that car appears, even if you've gone and bought yourself a different Hyundai car, which you've spent all of your life savings on, they'll have to say that it is a paid advertisement because you heard about that brand, you first experienced that brand through them gifting your product. And so what I think, in my humble opinion, is going to happen, especially at a low kind of cost value product, is that influencers are just going to put advertisement on every single piece of content. And then what that means, again, from a consumer point of view, is they're like, nah, they've got to do this. And you then, the lines become blurry than they were previously as to what has been gifted and what's been paid for. And with that, one of the things, again, that I just kind of sped that process up is influencer marketing can't be done authentically for everyone. So, you know, always, sorry to go down the feminine products there, but, you know, they've had influencers and I've seen the brief, it wasn't done through us. And it's like, on your bed, can you put rose petals, some pink packaging to talk about how you use Always when you're on your period? And you're like, well, one, this really isn't a experience where you're going into a shop and buying yourself flowers and talking about how, you know, wonderful it is to skip and jump that you're finally on your period. And so you're seeing this content and it just is glaringly obvious that it is paid for. And the best thing influencers can do in that instance is saying, no, thanks. I actually don't want to talk about this because for every one that I turn down, something that is far more aligned and better suited to me will sue. And you've seen all of the, or maybe you haven't, but there was the tortilla girl who, you know, had tortillas instead of pancakes in a morning bedroom shop. And some of it is just so ridiculous. But then you look at the briefs and you're like, these brands are giving influencers no creative control whatsoever around what is right for their feeds. And they're becoming so scripted. And my view is often like, don't do influencer marketing just because everyone else is and you think that you should be doing it. And again, it kind of comes down to the thing I was saying at the start. And if you are going to do it, make sure if you're Colgate, you're talking to someone that has spoken about the fact that they have wanted their teeth to be whiter, that they couldn't afford to get their teeth whitened professionally, and that is why you approach them, rather than the Colgate campaign that's happening now, which is every single fashion influencer has been paid a fortune around Fashion Week to talk about how confident they felt at Fashion Week because they've been using Colgate. Like, that is not how a consumer thinks or speaks. I waffled a bit for you there.
No. It's fascinating because I think that there's the idea, actually, one of the things that comes out of that for me is the extent to which you've got now this new breed of effectively media people who don't have the backing of large media organisations behind them. So they don't have all the resources of large legal departments within big media organisations. They probably don't have, well, actually, I imagine certainly your nano influencers don't have agents. They don't have people representing them. They don't have people giving them advice. And they're going to be held responsible as much as the brands are, quite possibly.
So
there's a real challenge there that actually, you know, these people could be used quite badly by brands as this becomes, well, as we're still in the sort of early foothills of what all of this stuff means.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a kind of agent's role building up for the larger influencers?
Yeah, and agents have to understand the ASA guidelines as much as the content creator does. And I think a lot of agents are still in the position, which is this is an ever-changing space and demand for social content rather than being the voice of a radio ad is creeping up more and more. And it's everyone's kind of trying to work out what the guidelines are as well as what they should be charging as to how many things they should say no to, what is actually right. And everyone is kind of learning together, but I do think there's a whole piece of, so there was the recent example with like Ellie Goulding, Rosie Huntington-Whiteley were called out that they have now been trained by the ASA. This is what you have to do. And this is what good looks like. But actually that's great. Because in my opinion, they've kind of used celebrities to create an influencer campaign to educate and to teach everyone else. But equally they should should be approaching agents and brands the same way with GDPR. Everyone had to understand exactly what it meant and what that impact would be, so that brands in particular, and we see it all the time, are like, I know we're like technically paying, but if you could make it look like it wasn't paid. And our straight away is absolutely no chance. Like, let us educate you and teach you the reasons as to why you cannot do that and the implications that will happen if that does ever kind of come into fruition. But there is still a lot of, you know, brands sliding into DMs, especially at a nano micro level, where the brands probably do know, or they could very quickly find out. Of course, the nano and the micro influencers don't necessarily have all of the tools at hand. And the brands are saying, you know, make it look like you did use this face mask on a Friday, or that, you know, you have wondered for years whether your teeth could become whiter with Colgate toothpaste. And then they're really heavily scripting their copy, the direction of their imagery. And that's what gives all of influencer marketing a bad name.
Are there particular demographics that are more targeted using these channels? Is it mostly towards younger people? Is it something that's spreading across generations yet?
It's definitely spreading across generations. The obvious is millennials are on these platforms all day, every day. But you can, for any influencers that you work with, you can get their audience demographic and their breakdown. So if you are to work with an alcohol company, you have to ensure that the majority of their social following is over the age of 25. And if you are a luxury car brand and you know that your average customer is 35, 40, again, it's worth getting that audience breakdown in advance and making sure that you are targeting the right type of people. But, you know, at the moment, cleaning is the fastest growing category on Instagram. And it is people talking about the homes that they own and their hacks to making sure that their house sparkles. I am desperate to do something with a cleaning influencer so I can take them to my house and it will not look like a state. But equally, brands that are targeted, it also depends on the platform. So it is a older audience that are hyper engaged on Facebook still. So you can do more with like 50 plus men and women targeting in that sense. And that's also, again, the art of the celebrity. Like if you are, so Freddie Flintoff is obviously the face of Giacomo, a menswear fashion retailer. That appeals massively to my dad, who is, I think, 56 or 57. Hopefully he'll never listen to this because I should know. But equally a Boohoo ad, which is aimed at 16 to 24 year olds, is actually doing traditional TV methods as well as influencer marketing. And it's being played in between Love Island because they know who is going to be zoning in and tuning into kind of what is going on in the drama of Love Island. And it is, I always think influencer marketing is an obvious hand in hand to a FMCG brand, fashion and beauty, because you can see this is what this product looks like on me. But it is actually getting increasingly more interesting when it is in more niche areas. So Atlas Bio is a poo testing company, and you ship it off in a box. Literally not the conversations you expected from me. But a lot of influencers do talk about their struggles with IBS, and they might be a beauty influencer or a fashion influencer, but this is like, sometimes they can't leave their house because of the agony that they're in. And actually, an Atlas Bio can get in touch with them and say, look, try this product. The reason why it exists is because of this. And the tech side of Atlas Bio is phenomenal. Like it comes back and says to you, right, these are the things that you may have. You need to go and see someone about X, Y, and Z. And you do not eat enough broccoli. You don't drink enough water. I'm sure sometimes they are far more advanced than that. But because that information is so useful, when the influencers do eventually then get their results back, they do want to talk about that, even though it's something that can be quite tricky to start with. And gut health is something that is absolutely huge at the moment. And you've got people kind of paving the way, such as like the MAC twins with their gut stuff product, which makes all of that stuff easier to talk about in a space which is quite narcissistic. Again, it is significantly harder. We've done stuff with a company called Avery Dennison, which is B2B, and they manufacture product for Vans, for Nike. The Premier League kits are all done through Avery Dennison, and they are, from a manufacturing point of view, the most innovative, and they do heaps around sustainability. So actually, we use influencers to get those messages across for them, knowing that actually B2B is still talking to humans. So they will pick up on that, and it raises awareness of like the innovation, the tech that they are using to get this product to market. There was an amazing campaign that annoyingly we didn't do last year with Dropbox, which again was all around like entrepreneurs of tomorrow. You do use Dropbox. It is safer to share products. And they used influencers to kind of raise awareness that way in a like-minded space.
Yeah, I guess for my days working at Microsoft, actually the tradition of evangelism marketing, there's two forms of it. The first is that you have people who are from the company who go and evangelize, and kind of most of what I did there was in that sort of space. But there's the other part, which are things like so Microsoft has got a thing called the MVP program, the Microsoft Valued Professionals, where they take people who are expert in particular areas of technology and they give them support to be able to go out and talk at events and all the rest. And that's it's not a, you know, digital channel form of influencer marketing, but very much actually that is an influencer marketing type strategy they've been doing.
Yeah. It's word of mouth. It's the same reason why marketing exists, just in various different places.
So just to finish this off then, just thinking about the needs of organisations. Obviously, you've got the outbound stuff about how do you be able to get customers to come to product, or how do you influence people to be able to, you know, become subscribers or whatever else. One of the other big challenges organisations have is around how they get change to happen within organisation, and how you get behaviour to change within organisations. And it strikes me that there's things that could be learnt from influencer marketing approaches to be able to get a bit more savvy about how word of mouth is used within organisations. Because at the moment, whilst most organisations will moan about how it's really hard to get change to happen and communicating stuff across the organisation is terrible, the grapevine in organisations is usually very effective, especially when it's bad news and things can sort of, you know, traverse very quickly. So if you could sort of take your external mindset and think, what sorts of things do you think people involved in change programmes and internal comms could learn from the approaches that you take when it comes to external marketing?
Yeah, well, I always say that a brand's biggest advocates actually work inside of that organisation, because they work there for a reason, they know what is going on, and they really believe in what it is that they are delivering. So I worked at ASOS for 5 years, and actually we recruited internal advocates that I sat within the social and influencer team, probably could have guessed, but everyone wanted to be doing social media, and the average age of employee was like 24. So we identified in various different teams people that became like the hero, stand up, this is how you create content, this is how you can then get that content distributed across ASOS's social feeds. We used to, as a social team, get into the office and there would be heaps and heaps of product, which might be like a banana jumper with a post-it note being like, hey, haven't shifted any units, can you please do something on our Instagram feed? And you're like, well, it hasn't shifted any units because it's a jumper with bananas all over it. So actually doing an Instagram post wouldn't necessarily work. But if you could take the time to, again, let people understand what makes a good piece of content, and getting those guys sending that through to us that then could be actually ease the workload of our social team, but also make people feel like they were part of the broader social experience. And they obviously got as excited as a customer does when their product is, or their image is received and by 8 million people that follow ASOS on Instagram. And that works across various different disciplines, like even here. So we've got 160 people that work in the group. We have got a sustainability champion, and they are showing the simple things of like which bin you should actually put stuff in, because crazy 20 somethings somehow don't seem to know, and through to like things that we can do as an organization that helps kind of again change the status quo and get people talking more openly around it. The same way we have a charity champion that rallies people up and talks about the charities that we support, and then they talk about that again within the building, but also outside of what the amazing things that they're doing. And ultimately that works for us too, that the people here do love, I hope, the projects, the jobs, the clients that they're working on, which is then again how you get new leads, by them being in the pub with their friend going, we can't believe we just increased such and such as average basket value by 5 times. And they're like, hold on, I need to do a bit of that as well. So I think when you can really easily identify the people within an organization that are hyper passionate And it's about taking that, really supporting it. And there's the whole fun HR drama of like making sure their line managers are aware and that their line managers are happy with the kind of extracurricular stuff. But 9 times out of 10, we've never really seen an issue with any of that when you've kind of taken the internal influencer.
It's interesting, actually. The other thing, as you were talking there, it seems to me is around HR initiatives around attracting new people into organisations. And those tend to be terribly badly curated for the most part. And actually, if you were to give people a little more trust and a little more free rein to be able to talk about why it's a great thing to do, train them up in how to be able to get short, punchy messages across and leave them to it. And of course, the issue is there's issues of trust and control that exist within larger organisations that tend to be barriers towards that sort of thing. But I could see that influencer strategies could be an amazingly effective way of being able to attract new talent into an organisation.
Yeah. No, that's a really good way of looking at it. And again, it's having the ability to like show off and talk about what you have done, but making sure that there are clear guidelines of, you know, maybe don't give sales data out on your LinkedIn profile when you're talking about how great something did. But I think once you put those parameters in place and you give people the trust to be able to do it and you don't try to make it look like a corporate campaign, it can actually kind of have that impact that you're after.
Fabulous. Just one final question then. You mentioned it a bit earlier, the fire thing. Do you think that's been a good thing for influencer marketing or a bad thing?
Totally, honestly. How can it, like, there are a million different ways to look at this. And what happened with Firefest is obviously appalling, and the impact that that had on the locals is really sad. And again, it is brilliant that Fuck Jerry was called, sorry, first of all, but it's his name, called out as obviously someone that had an impact, and they have, through their social feeds, managed to raise significant amounts of money to start to rebuild and make their lives the way that they were previously. And you can't really argue with a stat that they sold out of tickets, 95% of the tickets in 48 hours because of those influencers. So does influencer marketing work if you use the right type of people? Yes. But it comes back to the same thing we've kind of said throughout. You have to make sure that you know what it is that you're selling, what it is that you're partnering with, that actually they've done all of their due diligence their side so that the influencer, the business, the brand, the people involved don't have the negative impact and repercussions that they did. And I mean, we got off so lightly throughout this entire thing. But it kind of, it made an impact. It sold the tickets. It got people talking. Everyone wants to be a Jenner.
So thanks to Sedge for that. That was a really fascinating insight into that type of influencer marketing world and how you've got to think about those things. Or I think, how do you think about the kind of people that you want to amplify your message, I guess? And some talk there about fire, which is, everybody seems to have watched this Fire Festival documentary. I haven't watched it, mainly because there's not a lot of schadenfreude in me, and I also don't really want to spend my time watching people that I'd rather not spend any time with in real life. And that's, so I just haven't bothered with it. But, I guess it highlights some of the dangers of what an influencer is prepared to do in order to get paid, and how well people go about, how much due diligence people do of their own.
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges, as we talked about in the interview, about, you know, that the traditional big media personalities have been caught out in the past for doing daft things, often for tax purposes. Although sometimes in terms of sponsorship and you know, this kind of influencer model where you've got people who don't have big media organisations and agents and all the rest of it around them, I think there's even greater danger of that. The other bit, though, from that conversation with Sedge, which did a few weeks ago and it's been sort of bouncing around in the back of my head, is actually thinking about how some of these techniques for being able to raise awareness and be able to get people to do things, it just, for me, amplifies, I think, quite how monochrome the approaches of internal communications are to being able to achieve stuff. And that actually, maybe if internal comms people were able to look at these kind of models for being able to get awareness and be able to get, you know, messages transmitted, actually would things like a influencer marketing model actually work better within an organization than mass media broadcast models, which is where most internal comms tends to be focused. And I think there's something really interesting in that, that I've not really, the few internal comms people I follow on Twitter and the like, I've not really seen much talk at all actually about how influencer marketing is to be used. Maybe it's just stuff I've missed, but it just feels to me there's something there. And then also thinking about it in a B2B sense as well, if you think about the hierarchy of marketing communications, mass consumer stuff to young people is probably the peak of it, then more mass market stuff, then I don't know, people advertising to the elderly, which is weird because they're the people who've got all the money these days, but that's another story. And then you get into business-to-business communications and business-to-business marketing. And then internal comms is definitely, definitely the poor cousin of all of that. But the internal comms model of, you know, effectively broadcast and print media and not doing it, not being able to do it very well internally, what would happen if they actually started to look at this in a totally new light, given what we're seeing happening within the world of social in particular, and the opportunity to be able to identify people of influence in the organisation and work hard with them to be able to get them to stretch their influence when it comes to change programmes? And I think there's a huge opportunity in all of that.
I think there is, but I think also there's a, as you say, the two things are not seen as the same, in as much as there's a lot of money and time and effort and thought put into acquiring customers. Okay. Self-evidently, that's what a lot of companies are trying to do. How do we acquire a customer? And when you look at the marketing effort and budget, a lot of money and time goes into figuring out how they can persuade somebody to part with their money and acquire that customer. Well, once you start thinking in those terms, there's a whole bunch of question of ROI, how much it costs us to acquire a customer, etc. When you get to internal comms, those forces don't apply, and also it's not seen as a competitive situation. So you're not trying to persuade somebody to part with some cash for the thing you do, the reason you exist as a business. That's not what you're trying to do. You have a captive audience that you pay, and therefore you rightly or wrongly take the view that they've got to listen to what you say. And when you say, oh, by the way, now we're going to do it this way, everybody goes, right, we're going to do it that way. And the fact that that often isn't the way it works is probably it's missed because it's not seen as the same kind of communication, and it's not seen that it needs to be sold in the same way. And I'm sure we all know by now that, you know, those of us who've been around the block a few times and been involved in management at different levels, is that there are people in your organization who are influencers, and you know that if you try and change something, if they don't get on board with it, other people will look up to them and they'll follow their lead because they're seen as either kind of bulletproof or kind of the, you know, maybe, you know, even bulletproof, but I'm being a little bit negative there, maybe even they are the voice of reason. They are the person who actually knows when something's a bad idea and knows when something's a good idea, and we'll get on with the good ideas and we'll just slow just ignore the bad ideas, because they know, because they've been there long enough, they've seen it all before, and they just know the bad idea will go away if they ignore it for long enough, because it's not a very good idea. And we all do that as well, by the way, because we haven't got time to engage with everything in the same way. So you're absolutely right, identifying those people and getting them behind an idea is definitely a good thing. Sometimes the question is, why aren't you talking to those people first before you start your idea to make sure it is a good idea?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's an interesting question, isn't it? And if I think about some of the clients I'm working with or have worked with in recent years, I don't think very many of them accurately understand the people of influence in their organisations, because they still equate hierarchical power as being the only sort and sense of power in an organization, and that's just not the case. It's, you know, power comes from very different places, and, you know, who are your key influencers in your organization list? I think that's a fascinating starting point for any discussion about how you're going to get change to happen.
Well, yes, but how many times have you seen a common strategy written for just about anything internally? You know, you sometimes see them for external, and you most often see them when you're trying to, you know, when you get into proper marketing world. But even a small, any kind of change, really, it wouldn't hurt to have a tiny 3-line comms strategy about the people you're trying to communicate with and what you're trying to tell them, would it?
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, thanks again to Sej. Fabulous stuff. And we'll put a link on to the website to be able to get to her and to be able to get to her company. And we've got another interview coming up next week too. So yin and yang of the internet through our eyes. And we're reverting to the usual stereotypes of me being the dark side of yin and Christopher being the light and airy world of internet yang. So I'm going to get this off my chest now. And this is an observation out of just occasionally using LinkedIn and having spent most of Saturday on the march to just say, please stop it, about the Brexit thing. And the observation was how nobody seems to be talking about Brexit, particularly on LinkedIn, which I find a bit weird. And I think it's a deeper reflection of stuff that I think is problematic, actually. And I think it's problematic because I find it a bit weird that people don't feel they can talk about politics in a work context. And I don't mean by that to be hectoring and to be able to be, yabbering on about whatever it is that's on their mind politically. But business is not apolitical. And decisions made in business have an impact on the political landscape, and similarly, things on the political landscape have a massive impact on what goes on in our day-to-day world of work, whether that's commercial or public sector. And that there is no real discussion that I see across LinkedIn at the moment. It's still just pictures of people standing in front of flash cars that they've been able to, through their hard work and expertise, to be able to gain, which in itself is obviously a political statement, but that's another story. I just find it a bit strange. There should be a lot of people talking about politics on LinkedIn at the moment in the UK, because it's having a massive impact in the UK on businesses. And so I just find it weird and slightly disappointing. And why can't there be sensible grown-up discussion about what businesses should be doing, if nothing else, to be saying about what is it that the organisation should be doing at the moment to be able to deal with the complete ambiguity of what is going on over the next few weeks, months and years. And I see nothing.
That is interesting. And I do have a slightly different view of this. I am a little bit, I think it's a bit like religion. There's no real place for religion in work, and there's no.
I see more religion on LinkedIn than I do Brexit. And I do see, particularly from American, not necessarily my contacts, but, through the broader network, there's a lot of extreme religious views that surface up on LinkedIn.
Okay. I'm not entirely sure I see much religion on LinkedIn. Maybe I've just blocked everybody that would stand.
Maybe I should. But.
And that's, partly I do. I block people on internet on LinkedIn, or I unfollow them if they are if they just post crap or comment on crap. And sometimes you block them, like Oleg, whatever his name is, which LinkedIn gets 18.2% better as soon as you block him. And I was just thinking, one thing I have seen, and this only struck me as you were just talking, and I guess it's just because of the people in my network, I do see quite a lot of grumbling about IR35 and HMRC and the changes happening there, which is kind of political in as much as it's about a change that the government is bringing in. And there was a lot of talk around GDPR, which again was kind of political, although there was no, I guess when it's a political debate, especially we're using the word debate, when it's a political issue, the question is there one side and another? With GDPR, it wasn't really one side and another. It was kind of, well, here it comes. And most people could see the reason for it. I didn't see many people really saying GDPR is a disaster and it shouldn't happen. With the IR35 change, then there are a lot of people who have a very strong opinion on it, mainly because it affects them directly. And with Brexit, I am probably one of the irritating people who post on it regularly, and either post pages from Heather Burns' web, afterbrexit.tech site, or stuff that I've written, or stuff from DEXEU around no deal, because I just think it's something people should be thinking about. But you're right, that's not necessarily a big issue other than me crapping on about it regularly. And I don't know why, really, unless it's just things that people feel is just a little bit like religion. It's just a bit too sensitive, and they could end up being, they could end up getting into some sort of trouble, disenfranchising. You know, there's this whole thing about if you suddenly come down on one side of the fence, you might lose half your customers or whatever it might be.
Yeah, maybe that's a bit of it. For some people, they work under civil servants in the UK work under the Civil Service Code that basically removes most of their civil rights to talk about politics. There are situations like that, but I don't know. I just find it, for me, it further reinforces the vacuousness of discussion that goes on LinkedIn. I find it a very weak medium personally. And I just don't find it engaging. And the fact that there is no discussion around this stuff that I'm seeing is reinforcing for me maybe my prejudices about how LinkedIn is a place that is little more now than a contact book for me. But there we go. Anyway, so that's Internet Yin. Internet Yang, something far more enjoyable. Why have you been showing your mouth to a telephone?
Yes. This is something that we don't normally do this, do we, where we will have already talked about something on the group, on the chat group before it goes into the podcast, but couldn't really resist on this one because it was something that I can't remember how I came across it actually from referred to it called DNA Friend. And it's a website that if you go to dnafriend.com, welcome to the world's fastest and freest DNA testing service. And it's got a unique way of doing this, whereby you can open your mouth, take a picture of your saliva, send the photo, and then you get the results. And what a brilliant idea! And if you follow the process, they'll I'm just pressing on this now, and you get your saliva ready, and it shows you a picture of a hamburger, and then some ice cream in order to get the saliva ducts working. And now it's showing me a picture of a man's naked torso. So there we go. And essentially, you go through this whole process. And it is, of course, a satirical site. But it is really, really good. I mean, I don't know who the hell's put it together. And at no point have I come to a place where they've told me, aha, this is an informational site that you should, that's telling you why you should be worried about where people, you know, what people are doing with your DNA information. But it is superb, and it's full of, the more I read this, the more amusing it is.
There's a real depth to it that you don't often see on the internet in terms of satire.
And
it's
also
very, very good.
I mean, because it's the kind of thing you'd skim through and say, yeah, this is really good, because it says what we test for. And there's dozens of bullet-pointed things that if you read it, so celiac disease, macular degeneration, skeletal presence, largeness, chronic arms, balding, reverse balding, oxygen shyness, grandparents' disease, webbed hair. there's a whole number of terrible twos, bad intentions, extra head, and failure. These are all things that apparently they test for. I recommend it wholeheartedly because it's been keeping me amused for a little while. And submit your picture as well, because the emails you get are even more interesting. So yeah, absolutely. There's an internet yang for you.
Absolutely. So where can we find it?
It's dnafriend.com.
Fabulous. We'll put a link to that on the website as well. There we go. End of another show. Congratulations, Christopher, we've done it. Woo, go us.
Feel slightly vindicated with the fact that we started this whole thing probably at slightly lower energy levels than we normally would. But we've powered through, Matt. We've powered
yes.
through. You know, you've got a bit of a cold. I've just got a general feeling of ennui that's been hanging around for a couple of days. I think I'm probably being manly and fighting off germs.
Yes, I've managed the entire winter without getting ill once, and then the first sign of spring, there we go. We have an interview next week. Who are we speaking to next week?
Well, we're speaking to Laura Patterson next week about data and the way that people use it, specifically around subscription services in publishing. So that should be interesting.
Excellent. And then we've got another episode of I Must Read It Again. And if you're interested in those, if you go to the website and from the menu go to the I Must Read It Again section, I've extracted out all of the individual ones so that you can listen to them just as one continuous playlist of people talking about books that they should read again. So,
excellent. And that maybe can inspire somebody to do their own.
Absolutely. So if you want to take part in that, go to the website. All the instructions are there. Send us an audio file. We'll convert it into something beautiful and you will be a star of WB40. And then if you want to come along to our event that's taking place on the 2nd of May, you can find all the details of that on Eventbrite. We'll put a link on the website at wb40podcast.com, but you can also search on Eventbrite for WB-40 and you will find it. It's the one above the over 40s speed dating. That's it for this week. I can't believe that that's what we're billing ahead of, but that's what happens.
What we're competing with, because I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's it. with that, have a lovely week and we will see you next week.
Well done for making it all the way through this podcast. If you want to find out more, you can, as always, find it on our website at wb40podcast.com. Come and follow us on our Twitter account at wb40podcast. And of course, you can catch us on all usual podcast platforms. And if you do that, please leave us a review because we love it.